Cynicism rocks the vine in a time where violence blocks the sunshine. The Plan Puebla Panama, you can sort of picture it as an umbrella. And it's an umbrella of a series of projects. There's over 100 projects proposed just for southern Mexico alone.
Information will pass the wine, pass the buck, will pass the baton. But you can't pass the police or the Pentagon, the IRS or the upper echelon. I think it's time to make a move on the contradiction. Bomb, bomb. Rock the nation, take over television and radio station. Bomb, bomb, the truth shall come. Give the corporations a complication. Bomb, bomb, rock the nation, take over television and radio station. Bomb, bomb, the truth shall come. Give the corporations a complication.
We have a special guest this evening, the long-awaited visit of Brendan O'Neill from ACERCA, Action for Community Ecology in the Regions of Central America. We're going to talk a little bit about PPP, which is something we're going to have Brendan explain to us what that is. But we're going to start things off with a few questions, basic stuff. Brendan, can you tell us basically what the PPP is, and also first actually introduce yourself and tell us what your role is?
Sure. Puebla is a city in Mexico, just south of Mexico City. So the name sort of indicates, the plan involves basically it's been couched as what's called a regional integration or regional development project, which its geographical scope is from Puebla, Mexico, all the way down to Panama. So it's an enormous region, and basically it's, like I said, been called a development plan, and is different than a trade agreement. It's not the FTAA. It's not a trade agreement. It's a development project that involves a series of corridors, transportation corridors, being installed and built basically from Puebla, Mexico to Panama, that will be high-speed railways, highways, so infrastructure basically to move goods north and south up the isthmus from Panama to Mexico, but also east and west. So if you can sort of picture mapping it out, these corridors will crisscross across the Central American and Southern Mexico region, linking, like I said, Panama to Mexico, but also across the isthmus east-west. So there'll be a series of ports that will be dredged on either side of the isthmus, and those ports will be connected through high-speed railways as well as highways. And, you know, you can sort of picture this as something that is a necessary step in the eyes of sort of the globalizer towards integrating this region deeper into the global economy. Basically, without this infrastructure, it's harder to draw foreign investment, foreign capital to the region. And you'll see around these ports side agreements, trade agreements, other plans that will involve developing these ports into export processing zones. So sort of to step out for a second, the big picture is this is a response to globalization, a regional response, just like NAFTA and the FTA is a regional response to globalization. You're seeing here a regional response coming from Mexico, actually, from Vicente Fox, the president of Mexico, who has said, well, he's sold this plan to the rest of the Central American presidents, and as sort of the next step, the way to integrate deeper into the global economy, to be competitive. But as, you know, as I think many of us know and have come to see, this what really drives this thing is consumption. Our consumption here in the United States and Western European markets are basically vacuuming goods from the Pacific Rim, which has the cheapest labor, and China now in the World Trade Organization, you're seeing an increase in production in the Pacific Rim. These goods need to get to the East Coast of the U.S. as well as Western Europe. And how do they get here? Well, they actually have to go across and through this region. So you can sort of look at it geopolitically. This is a very important site for the globalizers to improve this infrastructure. But then we need to ask, who is this project really going to benefit? Who's it for? And why is it that this project is coming at this time, you know, in the context of the FTAA? We have to keep in mind that that's still out there. And then look at other regional developments like Plan Colombia, the militarization there, U.S. response trying to stomp out any sort of uprising and basically open up this area for investment, which means the people and ecology of the region will, we see it at Acerca, they will lose. So a long-winded response. But it's a big project.
It is. It sounds pretty complicated. Is it basically the Panama Canal? They are the same concept as the Panama Canal, except it's going to be all on roads?
Yeah, actually, this is the Panama Canal is an important thing to bring up. Supposedly, it can take as long as 10 to 15 days to move goods across the Panama Canal at this point. Hmm. And you've also seen the U.S. military back out of controlling the Panama Canal, thanks to President Carter, I think, actually did that to the total bewilderment of the rest of corporate America. So he handed that back over to Panama, which I think now is more controlled by private corporations than Panama anyway. But it's basically inefficient. And for the amount of goods that need to get to the East Coast of the United States, to these consumer markets, as well as Western Europe, it's just backed up, clogged up. So exactly, just like you said, we're not necessarily going to see wet canals. We're going to see what they're calling dry canals, which are high-speed railways and highways that are not made to move people, like a development project might imply that this infrastructure would benefit people. No, they're actually going to be to move goods faster across the isthmus, and the isthmus being the entire region of Central America and Southern Mexico. And in the meantime, be able to tap into cheap labor markets and natural resources in the region. And we'll certainly be even more empowered by trade agreements. In fact, just last week, President Bush came out saying that he is going to be negotiating bilateral trade agreements even before the FTAA is passed, most likely, with all the Central American governments. So this is sort of his response, is let's shore up our bilateral agreements so we can also get a piece of this, of the resources throughout this region.
Are there different countries benefiting in different ways from this? Is there any country, one country benefiting, or is it just corporations that benefit from these projects?
That's a really good question. It's sort of interesting. If you look at Mexico and U.S. relations, you sort of have this, you know, big brother, big buddy, paternalistic relationship. The U.S. Sort of showing its dominance over Mexico and has always screwed Mexico. So now it's sort of a, if you think of that response, well, Mexico turns around and says, well, you know, it's like the guy who beats his dog, and then mm-hmm. you know how that whole story goes. So Mexico turns around and says, well, there's cheap labor and resources that are available to us as Mexico throughout Central America and Southern Mexico, which is often considered a different country because of the high quantity of indigenous people. So they sort of say, well, it's like trickle-down imperialism, you know. Mm-hmm. It's basically the logic of the Mexican government is saying, well, this is what the U.S. does to us. This is what we're doing to Central America. So Mexico has definitely been driving the plan, but I think a lot of it has also been, is certainly an impact and perhaps even created in Washington.
And who is paying for this? Are these many different companies, or are these each country putting in a little bit? Is there any clarity on that?
Yeah, it's really an interesting thing, particularly, you know, working for ACERCA in terms of thinking of a strategy to resist something like this with our partners in Central America and Mexico. It's not, you know, it's like I said, it's not a trade agreement. The Plan Puebla Panama, you can sort of picture it as an umbrella. And it's an umbrella of a series of projects. There's over 100 projects proposed just for southern Mexico alone. Some of those projects include hydroelectric dams, which have had devastating impacts throughout that region by basically flooding land that's often indigenous land and territory, and displacing mostly indigenous people and a lot of rural farmers. And then you also have the industrialization of shrimp farming, which is an important, livelihood for a lot of indigenous people along the coast. You have the development of infrastructure, so highways that will be cutting through people's homes, towns, communities, dividing them. You also have the development of an electric grid. So a regional electric project that will, these hydroelectric dams will serve what is a regional grid. On the one hand, the word's development, but it's development of who? Mostly investors and corporations that, you know, you could say, well, the electricity will benefit, you know, people who need electricity, but these dams may be near people's communities, but often even dams close to people's communities don't provide these people energy at all. The energy actually goes to a regional grid and then is used not even in the same country, often along the coast. So they'd be used like in the development of these export processing zones where you'll see the maquilas. But you asked about funding, which is basically, I had to lay that out to explain that they'll be looking for private investment for the construction of some of these projects that are labor intensive, but they're also a lot of it is being driven by the Inter-American Development Bank, who has agreed to finance a good piece of it, including that the electric piece of it. But what you have is a number of projects under an umbrella that are divided up nation by nation, but under the PPP, they're looking at it regionally, they being the planners, who are particularly the presidents and the governments of the region, and the Inter-American Development Bank. World Bank is also a funder. The Central American Development Bank is also a funder. There's some Japanese private and public investment in the region, which is sort of an interesting link to the Pacific Rim, how I was talking about the increase of production there. So you have a lot of people who are interested in this region, ready to put money into it, but they're not doing this out of, you know, humanitarian development reasons. It's definitely because they'll be getting something in return. So basically, each country and each separate project under the PPP umbrella will have to find funding for it. So you can sort of think about that. It's an interesting thing to come up against as in terms of resistance. How do you develop a campaign of resistance against something so vast and something it has been boiled down. And actually, a lot of the people resisting the project are thanking Vicente Fox for putting a name to all these projects, because these are basically neoliberal projects that have been throughout the region. Already in process and will be ongoing, and now they put a name on a lot of these neoliberal projects, and the name is Plan Puebla Panama.
I was wondering, my experience was that the Pan American Highway was something that had been worked on and developed, you know, from this, you know, somewhat in some places superhighway and other places dirt road, stretching from, you know, the Darien Gap up to, you know, Alaska. Some people interpret it there, but, you know, basically being a main thoroughfare through the isthmus. And to me, I was wondering where the idea was coming from, like, to call it Plan Puebla Panama, because it sounds like there's lots of people who are doing things, you know, in their own neck of the woods. And at what point did they decide? Was it Fox, who was the one who really was the brainchild of making this large umbrella, which they could all find funding together? And
yeah, I'd say that's right. Fox basically said, well, these are projects that are going on already, but there's more that we'd like to have. And he put a name on these projects. It sort of packaged it, you know, packaged it for funding and investment, and said, well, look, we're cooperating regionally, you know, invest in our project. So that's sort of the logic there. And it's definitely been, Fox has sort of been a very paternal, and he's also paternalistic and a very charismatic sort of leader. And he's taken his sort of marketing skills that he earned at Coca-Cola, and he's marketed this plan to the leaders of Central America. So yeah, Fox has been sort of the main man behind it. Though the plan originally, a lot of the plan, at least the piece that is in southern Mexico, was actually sort of created years ago under Zedillo, President Zedillo. And just to add that this entire region, there's been proposals for the century, really, the entire past century, talking about how to move goods faster across this region. But what you've seen is a lot of resistance. And that's why a lot of this hasn't happened. There's been effective resistance that has said, no, not in my backyard. We're not going to get anything from this. It's just moving stuff across this region, and you know, we're not going to benefit. In fact, we're gonna pay for it ecologically and socially.
In the release that just recently came out about CAFTA, the Central American Free Trade Agreement, the bilateral agreements that you spoke about, one of the things that they seem to repeat over and over again in their justification and their to Congress for these agreements is that by spreading capitalism and the American-style economy through Mexico and through Central America, they're actually helping to spread democracy and actually help these countries with their human rights issues. And perhaps that's, you know, a way to get Congress to agree to this. What is your take on that, and how does sort of that issue tie into what the PPP is trying to do?
Well, my take on it, basically, I think that you know, this is sort of the total irony of this language, that this language of development, this language of free trade, that they tie it in their discourse and their analysis to democracy and human rights is just such a joke, particularly because most of these decisions and most of these plans, whether it be NAFTA, the Free Trade Area of the Americas, WTO, the Plan Puebla Panama, these things are drafted but behind closed doors. Communities impacted by them are not invited in. NGOs are not invited in. If they are, they're typically NGOs that have developed relationships over time with these people that we need to call into question as activists of sort of their compromises that they've made. So, you know, basically, I think, you know, it's using language and marketing a plan, selling an ideology of democracy, selling an ideology of development behind a motive which is basically, you know, let's keep our consumer lifestyle going up here in the United States. A lot of development and free trade, if we just think of it simply as control over resources, you know, how can we shore up that we can maintain our lifestyle here in the United States? Well, we need to leave our country to seek out new reserves, to secure new areas, to sell ideologies to people so that they can fuel our economy, fuel our lifestyle. It's a myth that people will ever develop the way that we have. not because we've done it so well, but because they can't. There's not enough resources on the planet, and it's not desirable, in my own opinion anyway, but you know, it's just simply, there's simply not enough room on the planet to live the way we do. So that we'll sell the sort of democracy and capitalism in the language of this stuff, but it's actually quite the opposite. You mentioned human rights. That's a great example. I mean, there's a number of examples, one in Guatemala in particular that I can think of a World Bank funded project, a dam project that was notorious for its human rights violations. Coercion is done at political levels, but it's also, you know, the military regimes throughout these countries funded by the United States have intimate relationships. So we really need to look at the relationships between militarization and neoliberal development, militarization and capitalism, and in the light of this need to secure resources, secure markets. It's pretty nasty stuff to be couching it as either development that's good for people or, you know, human rights and democracy. Many of the communities, particularly indigenous communities, have styles of governance that date back over 500 years, you know, before colonialism, and their decision-making processes are democratic, but in the true sense of participatory democracy, in radical democracy, in collective decision making and processes. That's democracy. That's something that's going to lead towards human rights. These people are being left out of these processes, and so we're losing valuable resources. You know, we talk about natural resources, but we're losing cultural resources. We're losing people that might have knowledge and information and wisdom that can really lead us towards who knows where, a better place. But we won't know if this type of sort of ideology and co-opting of language and manipulation continues.
I just want to also, you could speak about the distribution of or inequality that exists in capitalism, you know, Latin American style, where there's like no middle class, which the one we have here is even shrinking, but it's the haves and the have-nots, and that, you know, generally economic plans that exist down there, whether they're development projects or whatnot, rarely do the majority of the population see any large percentage of whatever investment or money that comes out of selling resources or agriculture or whatnot. Another reason to sort of doubt that a plan like this would benefit, you know, the people of Central America.
Yeah, no, I think it's really, in some ways it's fascinating, but it's more tragic than anything else. I mean, if you actually look at race as well and factor that into that sort of that distinction of class, and you have this sort of elite upper class in throughout Central America and Mexico. I mean, you have that throughout the world, but particularly in that region, what's interesting is we talk about it being a post-colonial period, but most, if you got a picture of all the Central American and Mexican governments, governors and presidents, if you look at them and you look at skin color, it's a lighter race. It's a more European Spanish descent, and basically, colonialism has been institutionalized. It's been, you know, we put a nicer name on it, a nicer face, and we call it development, and we call it, neoliberalism, or we call it any number of things. But in reality, they've sort of built upon these elite oligarchies, which you can look at families and trace back bloodlines in this region, the people who have controlled resources and capital and have been in power throughout this region are often people who have a 500-year history, and that's so since colonialism. So yeah, you know, when we talk about who's going to benefit from these type of projects, you look at who the leaders are, who of each country. You look at their relationships to corporations, just like we need to do here in the United States and throughout the world. And it's no surprise that presidents are and governments are going to be behind a lot of these projects. But that's not to say that there's not that there's like this unified collective. Just yeah, this is a great idea. I'm sure we'll see some vying within in terms of nation against nation, searching for resources and investors, and that's really the nasty part of this all is that you know it's this economic globalization is basically you know it's laissez-faire economics. It's the idea of how can I find the cheapest inputs to production. If I'm a CEO of a corporation, how can I find the cheapest inputs of production, you know, which is labor is a big one. So we talked about human rights before. Any sort of union or unionization, these type of movements throughout the region are considered threats to foreign investment. So unions are bad. So the irony there of using the language of these things are good for human rights is just so ridiculous. And just sort of what you'll see, particularly with maquilas, which are these factories, sweatshops, basically, is countries within the global economy are vying and competing against each other. The United States and other first world countries have these countries competing against each other, and they do that by driving down costs of labor, by stifling social movements that are somehow lobbying for progressive social change, for a voice, for that sort of thing. So, you know, if Guatemala has more expensive labor, maquila or a assembly plant or a factory will close down there and it'll open up in Nicaragua. Labor goes up there, they'll close it down, they'll go to the Pacific Rim. I mean, talk about development. That's what these plans are driving. That's the logic. That's the logic of capitalism.
It kind of sounds like the United States is pretty much out of this besides their investment or putting money into it to help fund it, which is huge, but it's kind of not the decision-making factor. The United States is not the decision-making factor in this project, but to me it kind of sounds like it is an open door. PPP is an open door for the Free Trade of Americas Agreement. It will help the Free Trade Americas Agreement if it goes through by providing a transit through that area for quick trade and for rapid movement of goods and services. So I can see a connection between the FTAA there, but is that being made right now within the movement and within the action that's happening in the South?
In terms of resistance?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, definitely. I was actually in Guatemala and Mexico at a conference in Xela, Guatemala. It was called the El Pueblo es Primero. So the Pueblo is first, and then it was en frente a la globalización. So the Pueblo is first in front of globalization or ahead of globalization. And basically the entire conference was dedicated to the Plan Pueblo Panama. There was over 800 people there from all over Central America, Southern Mexico, the U.S., Canada, Europe, and basically everyone's making that connection that, okay, this is the next neoliberal economic globalization plan for the region. It's, you know, a brother-sister relationship with the FTAA. The FTAA, they sort of need each other in the eyes of you know, if you're a globalizer, the two things need each other. So you have a trade agreement, you still don't have good infrastructure, you still don't have, you know, what they call stability, quote unquote, in the region, or, you know, you don't have access to labor or whatever, the port infrastructure is horrible, Shipping goods is difficult. So they need each other for trade. That they're calling it development is, well, it's nauseating. That the World Bank and you know, the Inter-American Development Bank, the IMF, that these institutions have the audacity to use the word development is just ridiculous.
I wanted to jump back to what you're talking about the conference in Xela, Guatemala. It seems like a few thousand people show up at a conference to talk about how they can counteract the PPP, that there's some positive resistance and some education happening, at least in Central America, if not in this country. What are some examples of some sort of hopeful projects of resistance down there against this? And do you think that they're making some headway?
Yeah, definitely making some headway. The conference that we were at, ACERCA went to, myself and I went with, Lauren from ACERCA as well, Lauren Sullivan. And what was really hopeful to us was that, you know, people talk about economic globalization, and they talk about this sort of, you know, the role of the nation state sort of disappearing, corporations and transnational institutions, transnational corporations are bigger than the nation state, you know. But on the other hand, what we have going on is this, you know, some people call it globalization from below. So we have these trade agreements, you know, whether it be NAFTA, the FTA, the PPP, which is a development project, that are forcing people into dialogue that have never taken place before. There's regional dialogue, there's regional resistance, there's people talking about, you know, PPP talk in their language has corridor, transportation corridors. People in Xela were talking about corridors of resistance. So that literally means wherever there's a project proposed, there's a group there to oppose it. And there's a group there opposing it, and there's groups there developing alternatives. And what you're seeing is regionalized solidarity, which is really interesting. It's really an interesting time. I think we get sort of, we overprivilege sometimes the globalizers, and we don't see that there's actually some great things going on. Like the fact that out of the Xela conference came a follow-up conference between all indigenous and rural peoples that were impacted by hydroelectric dams. You know, there was just enough talk at this conference about that, but not enough to really get into the details. So what you have is people throughout the region who are impacted in similar ways, different ways, but similar ways, in their own homes. And they have this valuable experience with confronting and encountering so-called development projects. So when these people are able to get together, and I say these people meaning basically I'm just saying who is at the conference, people get together and share their personal experiences about this is what happened to my community, this is how we organized against this project, or in this case, in many cases, this is how this project screwed over our community. When you have people building solidarity on such shared compassions, It's a beautiful thing. So you have actually follow-up conference just on dams. The entire region's going to meet people affected by dams. It might be nice to see that with labor. It might be nice to see that with shrimp farmers. And I think it's something that you're going to see more and more is people saying, well, if these corporations and transnational institutions are organizing across borders, so are we. And we have a voice, and we're gonna build our movements, and we're gonna build alternatives, and it's happening. You probably can only hear it on radio stations like this, but it is actually happening. You're not gonna catch it in any corporate media, but it's definitely happening. So there's hope.
Good.
Maybe you could talk a little bit about how that kind of resistance differs from the resistance that we saw in the late 70s through the mid to late 80s, you know, especially well, Guatemala in the mid-90s, but you know, it was a more seemed like more national-based resistance. Even though the policies, the economic policies were there in the region, at that time, you know, things have changed as well, you know, sort of the intensity, perhaps, of the projects and the policies, but people are responding to them differently. Maybe you could just talk a little bit about that.
Yeah, I think that's a really good question. And I also wanted to sort of to point out that I am a white male in Vermont. And I just wanted to sort of say that before speaking for the people of this region. I don't propose to do that. So all I'm doing is from my subjective point of view, looking at and analyzing and thinking through what's happening, but certainly in cooperation with sharing experiences myself and having people share their experiences with me in the different trips and experiences that I've had in Central America and Mexico. But yeah, I think you ask a good question. There's a couple things that come to mind from that question. One of those being this sort of decentralized forms of resistance throughout, you know, the Cold War era. You had a lot of power and control and funding and manipulation from outside of the actual countries. And that's not to, you know, necessarily badmouth what was happening at the time, whether it be a communist or socialist or any sort of leftist movement. But a lot of it was tied to countries that were not in that region and was driven by people that didn't really have a good sense culturally of the nuances and differences of the region, and we're sort of thinking more about the good of the whole, you know, there was sort of a totalizing discourse, a sort of totalizing way of looking at this that I think tended to, in some cases, really cause a lot of pain and suffering, particularly for indigenous people. Along that lines, you've seen this sort of, you know, with the post-Cold War era, you see a lot of cultural movements in different ways. I mean, the Taliban is a cultural movement. It's one extreme example. And then, you know, the Zapatistas are a cultural movement or multicultural movement. That's sort of the beauty of them. And you're seeing basically philosophies that are culturally embedded, culturally significant to people, and people are connecting with each other throughout this region and are able, in ironically, through a lot of the infrastructure and communication and different devices of globalization, are you taking this stuff and co-opting it, making it their own, and building solidarity in ways that are much more culturally significant, much more, people have more ownership. It's them driving the process. It's them making the decisions about their lives. And in many ways, you know, there's some wonderful things going on, even with film, people being able to document their own lives. Or the Zapatistas on January 1st, 1994, when the first day that they declared war on the Mexican government, you know, they were also declaring war through the media and internet and weren't allowing other people to represent them who were basically going to harm their image. They were representing themselves. So you have a lot of interesting things going on, and it's definitely new forms of organizing across borders. People are able to pressure their national governments by building solidarity with other organizations, other populations that aren't even physically within their nation state, and they're able to turn around and pressure governments for some change, albeit, you know, slow and that sort of thing. So it's really an interesting time, I think, in history. You know, there are people talking about the disintegration of the nation state as we know it, and a lot of these cultural movements are sort of showing that they're bigger, and so are transnational corporations and institutions. You know, you have all these different forces that are organizing beyond political boundaries. You know, this September 11th sort of brings up a lot of thoughts for me around that too, of what has happened and what's happened since, and our sort of, you know, nations that are harboring terrorists, we will fight you. Well, you know, we're harboring terrorists right here. I mean, it's not that simple anymore. You can't, you know, you can't really build a strategy of fighting, you know, in this case, a war that I don't even believe in. But if you were to fight it, how are you going to fight it through what is potentially a dying way of organizing, you know, the nation state? I rant and rave.
Wow. if I can, I'd like to bring it back a little bit to back to the Plan Puebla. Is it Puebla?
Yeah.
Puebla.
Yep. Puebla, Panama. And we didn't talk about where is it? What's the status of it right now? I mean, the plan seems so huge. You've got these ideas for dry canals, for roads between, you know, here and there, and then different dams and other projects. So this is something that's been proposed and is in the planning stages, and what's happening as we speak?
Yeah, thanks for focusing me. I was on a ranting
rampage. That's
all right.
Ranting is okay.
Yeah, it's a great question. Where is it now? Well, for one, I know for a fact that the Inter-American Development Bank has agreed to fund the electric projects, so the regional integration of electricity projects, which relates to, you know, the hydroelectric dams and relates to the displacement of rural communities in many cases. So that's what we're going to continue to see, is pieces getting funded at different times. So part of in building a resistance strategy, we need to be thinking about, well, who's funding it? Is it a corporation? Is it a bank? And when? And we need to really keep on top of this stuff. But in terms of big investors, the IDB is definitely pushing ahead, the Inter-American mm-hmm. Development Bank, with the electricity end of it. Mm-hmm. But right now, it's definitely in sort of an like I said, these are closed door policies. So we're definitely in sort of a research mode as well with a lot of the resistance. To try to uncover who's funding it. We know Citibank will be a big investor. I mean, Citibank is supposedly funding the World Bank now. The World Bank has supposedly turned to Citibank for loans. So Citibank, who owns, I think, now owns Banamex, which is the Mexican National Bank. So they own basically like over 80% of Mexican capital. And you'll see them be a big investor in Mexico, and some other corporations that are interested will like Grupo Pulsar, which is a big genetic engineering firm, both agriculture and potentially GE trees, genetically engineered trees, which is another campaign that that someone I work with, Brad Hash, of who works for the Action for Social and Ecological Justice, works on a GE tree campaign, if people are interested in that. And so we'll probably see these sort of side projects. A lot of paper companies are showing interest in the region, International Paper, Boise Cascade, mm-hmm. a lot of the same investors, Monsanto.
Right.
So a lot of the sort of corporate terrorists.
You said that in other movements, they've people that have been fighting globalization or those kinds of things have been successful because they've been able to represent themselves. In this movement, has the people of Belize, Honduras, Guatemala, El Salvador, Nicaragua, Costa Rica, or Panama been able to represent themselves in any of the meetings or any media campaigns? Is there active resistance in that way as well?
Yeah. I think it's a good question. Just to explain a little bit, we have a primarily northern based in terms of like actual headquarter coalition that met in Washington D.C. on October 1st. That is formed. ACERCA is a part of that coalition. There's, you know, about 15, now maybe 20 other organizations on it. And each organization has developed relationships over time with their partners in that region throughout Central America and Mexico. So we have to sort of improve our communication up here between organizations and share information, but simultaneously each organization has their partners in, you know, Central America and Mexico that there's information sharing going on there. So you're seeing improved information sharing than we had in the past, definitely. But there's always room for improvement. I think we need to keep finding new ways to strengthen dialogue between northern and southern groups and look at things like power and race and diversity and challenge ourselves to not represent other people. This is a shared struggle. So how can we share this struggle? How can we be helpful to the overall movement and progressive change?
Just to sort of add on, like I was saying, when I was in Panama in 99, and the entire length of the Pan American Highway from, you know, northern or southern Nicaragua, I mean, as soon as you cross the border to past Panama City, was under construction. It was like one construction site after another. The entire thing was being, you know, developed, increased the size, wider, you know. It was amazing. I couldn't believe it. The whole bus ride.
What year was that?
That was in early 99. But sort of getting back to another part, we were talking about the larger framework of PPP, and I was wondering how this might tie into the U.S. and also getting back to talking about the U.S. influence and U.S. interest. How does this tie into Colombia and Plan Colombia and economic interests that we may or may not have there?
Yeah. I think basically, you know, Colombia is the gateway to South America. So, you know, you have Panama that actually has the Kuna indigenous people who live on the Panamanian side of the border are often forgot. It's often forgot that they're also on the Colombian side of the border. So they're sort of in an interesting situation in terms of being sandwiched, basically, from the north by Plan Pueblo Panama and from the FTA, and from the south from Plan Colombia. So, you know, what's the relationship between what's going on in Colombia and what's going on with these developments in Central America, like the Plan Pueblo Panama, is a good question. I think, you know, we talked some before about trying to secure the region for trade, and you know, Colombia is an excellent example of that. We have with Plan Colombia of $1.3 billion that the United States has given to the Colombian military, basically. And the Colombian military, with U.S. tax dollars, is protecting U.S. corporations from leftist guerrilla attacks. And the guerrillas are saying, you know, get the hell out of our country. We don't want you exploiting our resources. We don't want you exploiting our oil. And that's not to glorify the leftist guerrilla attacks. They're also destroying the ecology of the region by bombing the pipelines. But, you know, what do? We send in, you know, we pay the Colombian military to protect our corporations. So, you know, I think the two plans relate. Basically, if you look at the region as the sort of dream of the capitalist consumer world, is to spread free trade and to secure resources in different areas. So if we can secure and sort of stifle any political change in Colombia, then we can you know, past the Free Trade Area of the Americas, and the Plan Pueblo Panama is the infrastructure that will improve that link, and the Free Trade Area of the Americas is the trade agreement that will improve that link, which equals, you know, profits and money and lots of stuff we don't need here in the United States.
Can you tell me, tell us actually, and tell our listeners, if folks out there want to get more information about the Plan Pueblo Panama and how they can get involved in international resistance against it. Where should they look and what should they do?
Yeah, thank you. You can call me at ACERCA, Action for Community and Ecology in the Regions of Central America. It's Brendan O'Neill, and our number is 802-863-0571. You can also check out our website at www.acerca.org that also has some good links to it. And you can also email me at columbia@acerca.org. And the Chiapas Indie Media Project actually has some great stuff on their website about the conference that I was talking about in Xela. Mm-hmm. In Xela, Guatemala. So, you know, doing a search by checking out their website would be a good place to look at. There's some other good websites too. Global Exchange has a good website on it. International Development Exchange has a good website on it, and a number of others.
So if you just go on search PPP or Plan Pueblo Panama, you most likely find some stuff.
Well, it would be an interesting experiment. Plan Pueblo Panama, you could do a search under that. You may not come up with a lot at this point, which shows that this project sort of, in some ways it's in its infancy, but in other ways it's already happening. So it's sort of an interesting state. So yeah, you could certainly do some searches. I've pulled up some stuff on the web, but also ACERCA has just put out a new green paper. So if you contact ACERCA, we have an article on the Plan Pueblo Panama written by Wendy Call, who is working down in southern Mexico with an organization called USAZONI, which is an umbrella organization of a number of different indigenous social and ecological groups throughout the southern Mexico region in Oaxaca. So we could get you that if you just drop me a line. We could mail you one. It's a good article.
Is there any other things going on with the ACERCA that you'd like to announce, or events, meetings?
Yeah, real quick, in the Peace and Justice Center, Wednesday, this coming Wednesday at 7 p.m., we're going to have a meeting on Colombia. I don't know if you've been tuning into what's happening in Colombia, but it looks quite likely that it's basically already happened. The U.S. just has sent 16 Black Hawk helicopters the day before peace talks collapsed in Colombia, which is I think no irony. And we're seeing a potential escalation in violence in Colombia between the FARC, which is a leftist sort of Marxist guerrilla organization, and the Colombian military. But it looks like the Colombian paramilitaries, the AUC, most of whom have been trained at the School of Americas here in the United States and are funded by the U.S. military, but are also on the U.S. list of terrorist organizations, the AUC. You'll see them potentially going into the zone where the FARC is in southern Colombia. So we're having a meeting Wednesday at 7 p.m. at the Peace and Justice Center to talk about what type of responses we might have, and also talk about a Colombia mobilization. There's a national mobilization in April. I believe it's April 19th through the 22nd. It's in Washington, D.C., and ACERCA is one of the sponsors on the mobilization, and we're organizing here to mobilize a group to go down and participate in that.
Well, I want to thank you, Brendan, for coming in and talking to us about this, and yet another way that corporate domination is taking over and lining their pockets and stealing away sovereignty from individuals and communities all around the world. So hopefully a lot of people will come to that meeting and take action against what's going on down there and free trade all around the world. So thanks again, and hope you'll come back and talk to us.
Yeah, thank you. And just to end on a positive note, I just wanted to sort of reiterate that there are, in resistance to things like the Plan Pueblo Panama, the FTA, and NAFTA, the anti-globalization movement is definitely not dead. It's I think post September 11th has been a challenge for everyone in many different ways, for good reasons, and I think people are definitely sort of redoubling their energy and rethinking some strategies, and it's definitely not by any means something that's ended. I think it may even be quietly strengthening and growing, and throughout the region at this conference in Shala, it was very positive to hear that people are organizing in new creative ways that are very offering hopeful resistance and hopeful alternatives. So there's good things going on in the world.